This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In Washington, justices on the U.S. Supreme Court are appointed for life. But here in North Carolina, we elect our state Supreme Court justices, and two of the seats on the state's highest bench are being contested in this year's election. In 3 weeks, when you head to the polls, you'll also have the chance to elect three judges to the State Court of Appeals. Now, these are important positions. The rulings that they make affect life here in North Carolina. Yet the races don't seem to attract the same kind of attention that the presidential, Senate, and governor's races do. And so we hope to address that inequity this hour on our judicial roundtable. We also plan to address some other issues of law and politics in North Carolina. But on this subject of the state Supreme Court justices, do we have enough information as voters to select justices to the state Supreme Court? How can justices and appeals court judges keep politics at arm's length in their jobs when, in effect, they have to become politicians to get the job? And how is the new state fund for judicial elections working? Our number here, if you want to join the conversation, is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. And Matthew Isley is with us. He's staff writer at the Raleigh News and Observer, and he joins us from his office in Raleigh. Welcome back, Matthew.
Good to be back, Melinda. Thank you.
Well, Matthew, we have two seats on the state Supreme Court being contested, three on the Court of Appeals, and I want to get to those races in a moment. But this year, for the first time, these races are, at least on the ballots, nonpartisan. In other words, you're not going to see the letters R or D after the candidates' names.
That's right.
Why is that?
It was promoted as a reform measure within the General Assembly. The idea was that judicial races in North Carolina had become quite competitive between the parties, the two major parties, often quite combative, and that that might not be good for the courts. There's also this background notion that we need our judges to be as impartial as possible, and that by asking them to run with their parties, presumably agreeing with their party platform or ideology, that that also probably wasn't in the best interest of the courts and the public. However, it should be noted that for almost a century, Democrats controlled the judiciary in North Carolina, and it's only after the rise of the Republican Party, which has had really striking success winning seats in the courts, that the General Assembly thought it necessary to make this change. So quite naturally, there are some Republicans who think it's just an effort to keep Republicans from gaining even more seats on the courts.
Now, what would be the argument backing up that case? That this is an effort to, you know, stymie the Republicans as they put more of their candidates on the courts.
It seems apparent that many voters believe, rightly or wrongly, that Republicans make better judges because they assume they're tougher on criminals. In fact, in North Carolina, it's hard to find a judge who's not hard on criminals. Nevertheless, people believe that, and it's also clear that over merely about the past decade, the North Carolina Supreme Court, for example, went from seven Democrats and no Republicans to now six Republicans and one Democrat who's fighting for re-election this year. So it could go 7-0 Republican on November 2nd.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, one of that race has Sarah Parker. She's the only Democrat and the only female on the state Supreme Court right now, and she is up for re-election. What can you tell us about that race?
Very interesting race. In some ways, maybe the most important this year for judges in North Carolina. You've got Justice Parker, who's a veteran of the court, actually found to be in a survey by NCCBI to have been the most conservative on business-related matters.
And that's the North Carolinians for Citizens for Business and Industry.
Exactly. Okay. Now, she's not quite as conservative on social issues, but she's kind of a down-the-middle judge, and she's opposed by John Tyson, who is a very bright and ambitious judge on the State Court of Appeals. He's running as a conservative. He's running on some issues, and he also touts his success rate in terms of the large percentage of his cases being upheld at the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we talked a moment ago about how these races are now supposed to be nonpartisan, at least on the ballot. And yet, you have written about the candidates not hiding from their party affiliations. In this case, Sarah Parker is a Democrat. John Tyson is a Republican. And I saw a campaign sign for him this morning just coming off the interstate. And in the corner of it, it didn't say John Tyson Republican. It said conservative
right in
the very top banner. And then John Tyson, you know, running for the state Supreme Court. So is this effort to make the races nonpartisan, is that working?
You know, we won't really know the answer until at least November 3rd, but I think it's fair to say that although the party affiliations won't be on the ballots, and no doubt there are some voters who will feel deprived of information they considered useful, most of the candidates are campaigning as partisans, and it seems to be equally Democrats and Republicans doing that, we found, and cited numerous examples of candidates from both major parties running as Republican or as a Democrat, going to party events, saying we're proud to be one or the other.
Okay. So we do have that one race that has Sarah Parker against John Tyson. And then there's this other Supreme Court seat for Supreme Court Justice. I got my absentee ballot the other day, and lo and behold, I'm looking at it, and there are eight people running for one seat.
That's right.
Eight candidates for that other seat. Now, why is it that one race has two people running and the other is, it seems like, most of a baseball team out there?
That's exactly right, or one and a half basketball teams. But it's a historical anomaly. The situation is this because it's an election to fill a vacancy that was only created 2 months ago when Justice Bob Orr, a well-respected justice on the Supreme Court, resigned. He resigned after the summer primary election, so there was no opportunity for voters to winnow down the eight candidates to two sort of finalists, which normally would have happened.
Okay. So what can you tell us about the candidates, about the eight candidates in that race? Can you give us a thumbnail sketch on them?
Sure. Quite a mixed bag. You've got two veteran judges. You've got Court of Appeals Judge James Wynn. You've got Howard Manning, Jr., who's a trial judge in Wake County, who, by the way, is the judge who's handled that long-running school funding case called Leandro. Mm-hmm. There's a former judge of the Court of Appeals, Betsy McCrodden, who's running. There's something called an administrative law judge, which is not quite what you normally think of as a trial judge, but nevertheless a kind of judge, Fred Morrison, running. There's a federal prosecutor, Paul Newby, who's running perhaps as the strongest conservative, at least according to his own campaign material, in the race. And three others, Raleigh trial lawyer Ronnie Ansley. You've got also Marvin Schiller, who's a Raleigh attorney, and Rachel Hunter is an attorney who practices in Durham and lives in Cary.
Now, is there any kind of polling that's being done that can tell us who may be ahead in this or who has the best shot in this field of eight?
Not that I'm aware of. I could only take a guess, and I caution it's only a guess. I would think that Wynn and Manning have pretty good name recognition, at least as far as judges go. Mm-hmm. Paul Newby, no doubt, is garnering a lot of support from sort of social advocacy groups, conservative social advocacy groups. Betsy McCrodden probably has some name recognition for having served on the Court of Appeals a decade ago. The other four aren't very well known, but who knows what is the basis for voters' decisions on Election Day.
Now, James Wynn was on the state Supreme Court. He was a justice previously.
Right. Just briefly, for two or three months.
Okay.
He's basically been a judge on the Court of Appeals for 14 years. He was appointed to the Supreme Court in the fall of 98. He ran to keep the seat, but did not win that election. He was reappointed to the Court of Appeals.
And he's the only African-American in the field there as well.
That's correct.
For the state Supreme Court right now. And Howard Manning, who, as you said, is the judge in right now, the Wake judge in the Leandro case, the long-running one about whether the state should be giving poorer school districts more funds to educate children there. Howard Manning is a Republican by party affiliation, but you've been reporting that he is the only one of these eight candidates to not seek his party's endorsement.
That's right. As far as I know, that's true. And he went out of his way to send a letter to the leaders of both parties saying, I really think you shouldn't be endorsing anyone in these races. It goes against the effort to make them nonpartisan. And whatever you do, don't endorse me. And they both took him up on it.
Okay. We're talking with Matthew Eisley, who is legal affairs reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. Adam's with us in Raleigh. Hi there, Adam.
Hi.
Do you have a question for Matthew Eisley?
I actually had a couple of comments. Number one, the Democratic Party has actually not officially endorsed any candidates, whereas the Republican Party has. So it is nonpartisan, but the Republicans have endorsed. Second of all, the people who the Republican Party have endorsed certainly do have specific agendas. If you look at their websites, Bill Parker, who's running against Linda McGee, talked about James Dobson, the conservative Christian author, who's anti-condom, anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage. And all of these people have very little judicial experience. You know, Judge McGee has many years, 30 years of experience as a member of the bar. Bill Parker has 7 years of experience in the bar.
Well, I'd like to put your comments to Matthew Isley, Adam. Matthew, are we seeing judicial candidates be more specific about what they would do once they get the job?
Adam's right that a number of the candidates are campaigning on a basis of issues. They're saying, here's what I believe, and I think it's fair to say they're suggesting to voters that I'm going to think more like you if I'm elected. Now, I haven't found one who has said, if I'm elected, I will do all I can to overrule abortion rights or to uphold gun rights or to uphold abortion rights. In fact, that's an issue that's nearly irrelevant at this level because, after all, it's federal law that makes abortion legal, and there's nothing the North Carolina Supreme Court could do to counteract that. I think, though, to Adam's other point, I think it's probably not quite fair to say the Democrat Party hasn't endorsed. It's true that among the four Democrats running for the Supreme Court, they don't favor anyone, but they have got all four on their website, and they ask Democrats, please vote for these Democrat candidates.
We are talking about legal issues today on our judicial roundtable. With us is Matthew Isley, legal affairs reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. We're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Coming up, we'll talk about the Attorney General's race. Also, the image of trial lawyers now that John Edwards is the vice presidential candidate. All that just ahead on the State of Things. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We're having our judicial roundtable today. We've been talking with Matthew Isley, a staff writer at the Raleigh News and Observer, about the upcoming races for the state Supreme Court. There are two seats on the state Supreme Court that are up for election this year, and that's just about 3 weeks away. Joining us now is Joe Kennedy. He is a law professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you.
Well, we have been talking about the politicization of judges and attorneys. It would follow or should be part of this discussion. John Edwards, North Carolina senator, vice presidential candidate for the Democrats. He made his living as a trial attorney, and a good living at that. It's a fact that the Bush campaign, his opponents, are reminding people of a lot. Often the president is mentioning, you know, John Edwards is his trial attorney. And they're doing this for a reason, because trial attorneys may not be the most favored creatures on earth.
That's true, but I think they were in for a very, very big surprise very early on. Right after Edwards were picked, Time magazine did a poll, and what they found of the people polled, 55% thought that the fact he was a trial lawyer showed that he was willing to fight for the average person against big companies. And only 26% of the people polled thought it meant he was involved with frivolous lawsuits. And I think they were stunned by that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the frivolous lawsuits is also, that's the second shoe that drops often when John Edwards is being discussed by his opponents. It's not just that he's a trial attorney, but frivolous lawsuit comes up in the discussion.
Right. I think what happens is you use the word trial lawyer, and it's a very loaded term. And what that evokes in people now is this idea of a lawyer who's just filing frivolous lawsuits, a lawyer who manipulates juries' emotions, and you know, in order to bring back verdicts that just aren't right. And now, if that were the case with John Edwards, we would have known about it in 1998 when he first ran for Senate. But the fact is, John Edwards had a distinguished record as a trial lawyer, and if there were any sort of case he was involved in that was frivolous, I think we would have heard about it long before now.
Now, much has been made of John Edwards being a trial lawyer and helping him as he runs for vice president, helping John Kerry's bid for the presidency. And I'm wondering if you, Joe Kennedy, can point out some particular aspects of those skills that may not be getting noticed as much of what John Edwards does. We've already heard about his great oratory on the stump. Mm-hmm. But is there something else that's a little more nuanced that those of us who didn't go to law school should know about?
Well, I guess what I'd say is I'd want people to change what they think of in terms of what great oratory is. I mean, I think the general public conception is trial lawyers succeed because they use these sort of rhetorical tricks to manipulate people's emotions. But you ask anybody who's been in a courtroom, either as a juror or as a trial lawyer, and they'll tell you the key to success as a trial lawyer is immersing yourself in the facts and coming through the other end, being able to simplify things and to use the facts in arguments. I mean, people think jurors get their emotions manipulated in trials. Yet if you ask anybody, well, could a lawyer manipulate your emotions? They'd say, well, of course not. I'd base my verdict on the facts. And that's what happens in courtrooms. So I'd say the first thing is Edwards uses facts. Now, he does use, sometimes what you'll see him do is he'll use facts to paint word pictures. He'll take concrete things and put them together to try and help the facts sort of come alive. And he did that in his nominating speech when he had the little passage about, a mother sitting alone, wondering, worrying how she's going to pay her bills with her husband was fighting in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Now, he also knows what not to say, too. I've often heard it said that a good attorney will never ask a question he or she doesn't know the answer to in court. And have you seen some aspect of that, say, during the debates last week, the debate with Dick Cheney?
Sure. I mean, the second thing that trial lawyers will tell you and that John Edwards says in his book is the key to success in front of juries is credibility. Your credibility is the most important thing, because ultimately you can only take the jury so far with the facts, and there comes a point where they have to trust you in terms of the facts you selected and how you presented them. You'll notice that in the debate when Dick Cheney said, and we've never met, and that was his sort of big punchline, Edwards didn't contradict him. And one can speculate, maybe did he not remember meeting Dick Cheney? But probably what's more probable is, unless he could specifically cite chapter and verse when they had met, he wasn't going to go there. Because he learned over the course of his years trying cases, the most important thing is your credibility. And you don't even want to be a little bit wrong with anything you say. And that's something the trial lawyers learn.
Mm-hmm. So Dick Cheney may have been wrong, and Edwards knew he was most likely wrong about saying we'd never met before this time. But because he couldn't cite the exact date, you're saying, and couldn't credibly say that he just decided to leave that whole thing alone and let the bloggers take care of it the next day?
Yeah, well, I guess I'd have trouble just sort of saying Dick Cheney may have been wrong. I mean, the pictures I've seen, the radio clips I've seen, seem that they certainly did meet. And so I think you're right. I think unless he can really quote you chapter and verse, and if there's any possibility in his mind, maybe he thought, now let's see, we were on the stage. Did we actually shake hands? If he was just 1% unsure that they actually shook hands, I think he said he's not going to say it. Because, again, credibility is the most important thing to a trial lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is one aspect of trial lawyering that does, even among those who would be advocates for trial lawyers, would say sometimes the huge fees that trial lawyers collect in malpractice cases, their share of it, mm-hmm. may stick in the craw of some people. That's a lot of, they may be doing very good deeds for people who were wronged by the system, wronged by corporations or malpractice by doctors. Yet their cut seems so large. And I wonder if for all his talk and all his rhetorical skills, can John Edwards overcome that particular aspect of it?
I think he has been able to, and he can once it's placed in context. And the context is we do not live in a highly regulated society. I mean, if a doctor makes a mistake or if a company produces a defective product, there is not government agencies looking over everyone's shoulder all the time. So the only way these mistakes get brought to the fore is if a lawyer is willing to invest thousands of hours in litigating against a large company or an insurance company. And what you have to remember is for whatever money they recover on the cases they win, that also covers the cases they lose, and it also covers the thousands of hours they spend interviewing potential clients and deciding whether or not they're going to bring their case at all.
Mm-hmm. Matthew Isley, I'm curious your take on this in covering courts and covering court cases. Are you seeing any change in the way trial lawyers may be perceived with John Edwards so much in the limelight these days?
It's hard to know that, although his involvement has probably increased the role that trial lawyers are playing across the country, but also insurance companies and doctors. Just two other quick thoughts. The scenario has always intrigued political reporters like me because John Edwards, in fact, was such a successful lawyer, he not only presumably didn't take frivolous cases, he wouldn't have. And the cases he took were typically quite meritorious. And as soon as the door is open, he can obviously come back and say, well, let me tell you about the cases that I handled. And they're all quite sympathetic. So it's hard in his case to argue that he was just chasing ambulances for small-time car wrecks. The other is that the American Bar Association has just published a book, America's Lawyer Presidents, and it notes that 25 of our past presidents were lawyers, and among them were Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Abraham Lincoln, who really founded the modern Republican Party, and even Thomas Jefferson. So it's hard to know whether the Republicans will get much traction with that. I suspect it's really aimed at juicing up the base, the really conservative members of the party who just have an instinctual dislike of trial lawyers.
But is there any traction to be had with those? How many times have we talked about the undecided voters?
Yeah.
Is there any traction that they can get with that tactic, do you think?
I doubt it, but Professor might have a better idea.
Joe Kennedy.
You know, I'm not going to presume to guess about these mystical undecideds. I will say this. I think it's a really good thing for the legal profession, because I think what people see in John Edwards is an example of a trial lawyer who is a very straight shooter, who speaks very clearly, who uses facts. And I think that's a good thing for all lawyers, because what the National Manufacturers Association, some other client groups, sort of mobilized a public relations campaign against tort lawyers, but it ended up really affecting the image of all lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to the phones. Marshall is in Chapel Hill. Hi, Marshall.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
One of the things that strikes me about this issue of trial lawyers in this campaign is that no one is really rebutting the charge that tort reform is necessary by simply explaining that insurance premiums are invested by the insurance companies in the stock market. And when the stock market doesn't go up, as it has not over the last 3 or 4 years, then those companies have to raise premiums.
Joe Kennedy?
I think that's right. The other thing I think that you need to add in to the picture, to the context, is that, you know, we don't live in a welfare society where if somebody gets hurt badly by a defective product or by a mistake of a professional, that there's some government fund out there that's going to step in and take care of them for the rest of their life. We don't live in that sort of society. So if you don't have tort lawyers and tort litigation, those people just suffer for the rest of their lives wrongfully.
Okay. We could probably do a whole show on malpractice and the doctors versus lawyers angle, but let's go to the phones again. And Chris is in Raleigh. Greetings, Chris. Did you have a comment for our guests?
Well, I had a question, again, talking about some of the new judicial campaigns and whether or not, I'm just asking about theories here, we're seeing more issue-based campaigning under the new canons, not just because of the changes that came down from the Republican v. White case, but also because of the success maybe some of the candidates had using that in 2002.
Mm-hmm. Matthew Eisley, can you bring us up to speed on some of this?
Yeah, Chris Haggerty's talking about changes in North Carolina's rules for judicial political campaigns, which were in reaction to a U.S. Supreme Court decision. In fact, the North Carolina changes went far beyond what the U.S. Supreme Court ruling required. I think, though, it's fair to point out that as far back as the mid-90s, we had candidates for these appellate judicial races running on issues. And in fact, in 97, our state Supreme Court said that these candidates may declare their views on any issue. What they couldn't do was say, if you elect me, I promise to do something about it.
Has anybody done any analysis to see whether those who, like, say, since 1997, when they could say that, this is how I feel, whether that played out when those issues came before them, whether they did, in fact, vote that way, even though they didn't quite make a promise to do that?
I have not seen an analysis of that by anyone, and maybe Chris has. I would note that Justice Ed Brady ran on a very conservative platform 2 years ago, and he has written a few dissents and concurring commentaries that indicate he's quite a sincere conservative in terms of his sort of social philosophy. I can't offhand think of a case, though, that turned on an interpretation by a justice who was following through on a campaign promise.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we also, for the first time this year, I believe, we have the candidates for these appellate courts getting public financing, Matthew.
Right.
How is that going? And that's a case where they're promising not to spend more than X amount of dollars, and they're going to get their campaigns financed through public funds.
Yes, and your caller, Chris, is very heavily involved in that. It's turned out to be a bit better than it looked in the spring that it might go. The state found some additional money so that most of the campaigns of candidates who are interested have been fully funded in this sort of wacky eight is enough race for one Supreme Court seat. They're having to divvy up the money, so they've each got much less than they otherwise would have.
About how much are they running with, each person?
Roughly $200,000 if you've got the full amount, say Parker and Tyson, and about $40,000 if you qualified for participation in the other Supreme Court seat. Now, not all of them sought it, and a couple who sought it didn't qualify because they didn't raise enough on their own at the outset.
That's an irony that you have to raise enough in order to get the public financing.
Well, the idea there was you have to demonstrate you've got some level of support broadly across the state. You have to raise a certain number of contributions that could not all be huge. So you're presumably a pretty credible candidate. And then if you can prove that, then you can tap into the public financing fund.
Okay. Well, Matthew Eisley, before you go from us today, I wanted to talk a little bit about another race of interest to those who follow the law, and that is for Attorney General here. Roy Cooper seeking re-election, a Democrat, and facing Joe Knott. There was supposed to be a debate, but Joe Knott backed out recently of that debate. So are we going to see a debate between these two men who want to be the highest prosecutor in the state, the attorney general?
It doesn't look at the moment as though we will. It's true that they had agreed to a debate at UNC Law School, and Mr. Knott, who's a Raleigh attorney, former federal prosecutor, backed out. He said that he backed out because the time conflicted with the date of a gubernatorial debate, although it was earlier in the day. And they didn't want to compete for news coverage. Not quite sure what to make of that. But he did offer a counterproposal, which is let's have an old-style Lincoln-Douglas-type debate. No moderator, no audience questions. Let's just go at it, you and me, about which one of us should be attorney general. Cooper declined that, and it now looks as though we won't also have another opportunity to see them on a UNC TV program, which apparently not indicated he was willing to do. But Cooper declined.
Mm-hmm. Now, Roy Cooper, he has a couple of issues out there, one of which is hanging on since the 2000 race. He was sued over campaign ads that he ran back in 2000, the attorney general, and that's still hanging out there, has not been resolved. Is that hurting him in any way in this race?
We don't really know that. Possibly it's not hurting him as much as it would have if the trial had occurred by now, and he'd lost it, of course, and one strategy of his attorneys throughout has been to delay the case past the 2004 election. They've sought for a quick ruling in their favor before getting into sharing information with those who sued. They certainly want to avoid a trial. So, yeah, that's still hanging out there, and some have speculated that it may still be there in 2008 if and when he's running for governor.
Now, the kernel of that lawsuit against him is that he said things that were not true about his opponent in a campaign ad, at the very, if I were to boil this down.
That's right.
Is that affecting his ads this time around? Are you noticing any say, just holding back on attacks? Or?
Well, this campaign has not been as active as the 2000 campaign on either side, as far as I can tell at this date. My guess is that because of that case, and in fact another one on similar issues, probably a lot of candidates are a bit more tentative this time in unloading on their opponents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll see how this plays out. Matthew Eisley, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Matthew Eisley is staff writer covering legal affairs for the Raleigh News and Observer. Joe Kennedy is with us. He's professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. And right now, we turn to the Alan Gell case. In 1998, Alan Gell was sent to death row for the murder of Alan Ray Jenkins. Gell spent nearly 5 years on death row, almost a decade in prison overall because of this case. But along the way, it was determined that the prosecutors in that first trial had withheld evidence that would have exonerated Alan Gell. A second jury this year found Gell not guilty. And recently, prosecutors in the case received the weakest disciplinary action from the state bar. The prosecutors received a reprimand. And joining us now to talk about the latest development in the case is Alan Gell, who joins us by phone. Hi there, Alan.
How are you?
Fine. Thank you for being with us today. And Joe Neff is with us. He is the Raleigh News and Observer staff writer whose reporting revealed misconduct by Alan Gell's prosecutors. Joe Neff's work eventually led to the retrial and acquittal. Welcome, Joe.
Hello.
Hi there. Well, Alan Gell, I'm curious to know what you think about what happened at the state bar a few weeks ago when the prosecutors who had withheld evidence in your case went before the state bar for a disciplinary hearing and they received a reprimand, which is the weakest disciplinary action they could receive.
Well, the first day of the hearing, I was unable to attend because I'm in college, enrolled in college full time now. The second day, I didn't have any classes, so I came and sat in. I had to rely on others to fill me in on how the first day went. As things ended and they were found responsible for some of the things that they were and were given reprimands, it was a fairly large letdown for me during the defense part of the hearing. I kept getting the message, you know, put out in the air of we didn't mean to, we didn't know, there was not intent. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if this was a court of law and you were saying I did not mean to run a stop sign and hit another car, you'd still be held responsible for your actions. And as it was, they were not. And after the hearing and speaking with other people that attended and all, I was informed that the prosecution that was actually bringing the charges up on these prosecutors didn't really prosecute to the fullest as they could have or should have. For instance, we didn't have any witnesses called for us that could have been called. Some things that were explained by the prosecutors from our first trial could have been, you know, proven to be inaccurate had the prosecution called other witnesses. I've been told that it was a fairly bad hearing all in all.
Well, I'd like to talk with you a little bit more about it, but we have to take a quick break right now. But if you could hold on the line for us, Alan Gale and Joe Neff, we'll be right back to talk about this on our Judicial Roundtable today. And Joe Kennedy with UNC School of Law, UNC in Chapel Hill. We'll continue our conversation on the Alan Gale case and more. All that ahead on The State of Things. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. It's our Judicial Roundtable today. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. We're talking right now about the latest developments in the Alan Gale case. We are talking with Alan Gale and reporter Joe Neff. Also with us is UNC Law Professor Joe Kennedy. Just to recap, Alan Gale had been convicted of murder in 1998, spent 5 years on death row, and then it was found that his prosecutors had withheld evidence. The second trial found Alan Gale not guilty. And recently, the two prosecutors who had withheld the evidence went up for a review by the state bar, and they received the weakest disciplinary action from the state bar, a reprimand. Alan Gale, just before the break, you were saying you felt as though there wasn't a very stiff prosecution, if you will, of the prosecutors in this case. And nobody was making a case about what you felt as strong a case as you felt they should have made against them.
Yes. It has happened that I'm not one of the only people to believe that the prosecution didn't aggressively pursue things. Since the hearing, a great number of lawyers and people have written to the bar, and as things turn out, Wednesday, October the 20th, the bar is actually going to have another hearing to look at how the prosecutors prosecuted the prosecutors that withheld the evidence in my case, and also to, you know, review that. To me, it was another letdown by the system to see that, you know, traditionally defense lawyers are punished far greater than prosecutors, and I was hoping that in some way my case, not that I have terrible feelings towards the prosecutors in our case, if it was unintentional and was just I didn't read my file as I should have, it still affected a human life and almost took a human life, if not for litigation through court. And I was kind of hoping that my case would set some kind of notch where we have repercussions for, you know, actions by prosecutors. If they withhold evidence or conduct themselves bad, they know that there's repercussions behind their actions. And as it is, the bar traditionally here in North Carolina just doesn't punish prosecutors.
The prosecutors said, Joe Neff, the prosecutors were saying that theirs was an honest mistake. And it seemed as though the state, as you followed those proceedings, it seemed that that's the state bar in taking the disciplinary action it did, accepted that explanation.
Yeah, the three-member panel who were the judges in this case accepted that, that it was not intentional. But then the state bar lawyers who prosecuted the case never alleged or put on any evidence that it was intentional. And that is one of the the main reason for the enormous backlash you're seeing within the bar over the conduct of this hearing. I have a letter here that one of Allen's lawyers wrote to the state bar, Joe Cheshire of Raleigh. And Mr. Cheshire has been trying cases at the bar defending lawyers accused of misconduct for over 20 years. And he said in this that in his two decades of handling cases like this in front of the state bar, I'm not sure I've ever seen anything like this. The fact that there were no witnesses called by the bar, the fact that key people were not interviewed. Allen was never interviewed, and I think actually more importantly, his lead defense lawyer at trial, Maynard Harrell, who specifically asked for this sort of evidence that was withheld, was never contacted by the state bar. And so there
was any explanation given for that?
Well, I talked to the David Johnson, the lawyer for the bar who conducted the case, and he said he was relying on all of the paperwork that was in the file, the withheld evidence, the withheld statements, the withheld tape recording, and the court file. He was working out of that, and he interviewed under oath the two prosecutors in the case, David Hoke and Deborah Graves. And so that was his case. The problem that many defense lawyers or members of the bar have with this is that by doing so, he never really put Hoke and Graves to the test and challenged their story. And it must be said, on the other hand, is that there are many members of the bar who felt that this prosecution should have never taken place. Judge Erwin Spanar, a trial judge from Cabarrus County, was a character witness for David Hoke at this disciplinary hearing, and he stood up and said that he's been talking with all the other Superior Court judges around the state, and all 105 of those Superior Court judges are appalled that David Hoke was having to go through this disciplinary hearing. So there are some polar extremes here. Some saying too aggressive, some saying not aggressive enough.
Well, I want to check in with Joe Kennedy, then get back to Allen Gale.
Yeah,
Joe Kennedy.
I mean, the argument is essentially that they accidentally almost put the wrong man to death, and that they got off with a reprimand or a warning. Now, in any context, if someone's life is on the line, you would expect the highest standard of care from them. So for them to get such a low, even if you take their defense in good faith that it was an accident, you expect the highest standard of care when someone's life's at stake. You should still expect a high standard of care, even if you're talking about sending the wrong person to prison. I mean, what sort of message does this send to prosecutors in this state? I mean, imagine someone who has a robbery case, and they have a defendant whom they believe is guilty, who was caught running away from the scene of a mugging, and, you know, they file charges. And now they're predisposed to believe that they have the right guy. They don't think they're prosecuting the wrong man, but this other witness comes forward and says, well, he was short, and the defendant they have is tall. Well, what's the incentive for a prosecutor who believes that he's got the right guy to turn that statement over to the other side? Because now he believes the person who committed the crime may get off because of this conflicting witness statement. What this case says is, look, even if this were a murder case, even if the defendant were facing death, nothing will happen to you if you get caught not turning that over. And that is the wrong message to send.
Mm-hmm. Allen Gale, you just heard Joe Neff say a moment ago that there are many judges in the state who felt as though the prosecutors in your first trial, David Hoke and Deborah Graves, should never have even had to go before the state bar. But there is, as we're hearing, this backlash of people who feel that they got off too lightly when they went before the state bar a few weeks ago. And then there's this public hearing coming up to take more comment from people about what happened. What do you hope happens out of that?
Well, all along since I've been released in February, I've tried to make it a goal of mine to try and ensure that nobody else has to go through the things that I have to, you know, had to endure over almost a decade. And it's, for me, the bar hearing that has already happened was my one shot or one chance at having some sort of, like I say, repercussions behind action set up, and it didn't happen. And, you know, I actually questioned this accuracy of the statement from the Superior Court, Superior Court judge that said that all 105 are appalled by it. I think that the fact that David Hogue, as the number two administrator of the courts, being their boss that oversees them, probably would have liked to have heard that. You know, not sure how accurate that is.
We should explain
sure
that, yes.
One of the 105, which was a judge that on two occasions ordered it to be turned over, one appalled. He was happy and probably hoping that something was done. I'm not exactly sure what I expect to happen on the 20th. I do think that when it comes to defense lawyers and prosecutors not doing their duties as they should, that maybe the bar shouldn't be the one that decides the discipline on it. Maybe it should be the same thing that decided to send me to death, which is 12 jurors. You know, as it is with prosecutors and defense lawyers, you've got a self-policing force. You've got lawyers and prosecutors deciding what happens to lawyers and prosecutors. And it's, in its own way, it's sort of an anarchy, and I got a real good glimpse of it with the hearing for the prosecutors in my case.
Yeah. Joe Kennedy?
I think Alan...
Can somebody else police the lawyers?
What I was going to say is I think Alan is on to something that's very true, which is that judges almost are very reluctant to ever refer prosecutors for any sort of disciplinary action for withholding exculpatory information. I mean, Rich Rosen, one of my colleagues at UNC, did a study a number of years ago. He wrote to judges all over the country asking them to if they knew of instances where they had referred prosecutors for failing to turn over exculpatory information. And the results were essentially judges almost never do it. Now, so here you have a case that was so obvious and so extreme that it did get referred to the disciplinary authority of the bar, and of course, all you get back is a reprimand. So the big picture is, in the first instance, judges will almost never force this issue because prosecutors appear before them every day.
But so do defense attorneys.
They do indeed, but it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for judges to have to take one of the lawyers who are before them day in and day out, with whom essentially have to work in a fashion to keep the system running, and to say, you violated the Code of Professional Responsibility. Your career as a prosecutor should be over.
And as Alan Gell alluded to a moment ago, since he was the prosecutor in Alan's first case when Alan was sent to death row, after evidence was withheld, David Hoke has gone on to become—he oversees the court system, and that's why.
Sure.
Alan was making the case that perhaps he had influence. Oh, is that what you're saying, Alan? Did you feel he had influence over the judges?
I'm thinking that it would have been really hard for a judge to come in and say he should not have done that. He was wrong for doing that because, at the same time, you know, you're talking about your boss.
I'm curious about one other aspect, Alan Gell, of this, and that is that the other prosecutor, Deborah Graves, went on to become a public defender. And she's defending those who don't have enough funds to represent themselves, hire an attorney in the federal court system.
The whole thing that bothers me the most is, I wouldn't want anyone to believe that I think that these two prosecutors from my first trial, through malicious thought, said, I'm not going to turn this over. The fact, and when they were asked to explain themselves, it was, we didn't read our full file. And for me to hear that in preparing for a capital trial where you're trying to have a man executed, it seems that you would read every bit of your file and make sure that everything that you're doing to try and have this man executed is being done for the right reason. To have a file that's not an extremely thick file, not completely and thoroughly read, and proceed on to seek a death sentence on somebody, to me, that's extreme and gross neglect.
You know, there is. I can't resist tying this back to your earlier discussion about candidates for judicial election running on sort of themes of responsibility and being tough on crime. Well, I mean, that door should swing both ways. If part of your sort of the judicial philosophy, one, is holding people accountable and responsible for their actions, then it seems that out of these 105 judges who supposedly support, you know, think this was too stern, some of them would feel that these prosecutors, even for an accidental omission, should have been held responsible in a more meaningful way for this sort of mistake.
Mm-hmm. Joe Neff, what could the other disciplines have been other than a reprimand that was given by the state bar to Deborah Graves and David Hoke? What was perhaps the next highest level of disciplinary action?
The next one notch up would have been to have their license suspended for a time, and then typically that suspension is stayed as long as they behave well and don't get in trouble. The next level up would be a full-out suspension, and the ultimate penalty at the state bar is disbarment and loss of license.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is this public hearing that Alan Gill was talking about a moment ago that's coming up next Wednesday, the 20th. It's at the Sheraton Capitol in Raleigh at 11 o'clock in the morning, about an hour. And this is a case where members of the bar council will be asking questions of those who handled that recent bar case against these two prosecutors, asking them questions. But the public would not be able to ask questions there, nor, I gather, would Alan Gill be able to.
No, my understanding, you're correct. The ground rules are that the council, which is there's one council member for every judicial district in the state, and it's sort of like a legislative body for the bar, that they will be able to ask questions and of the staff who tried this case for the bar, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Alan Gill, did you ever hear from the prosecutors after the prosecutors from your first case after that sentence was thrown out? You got off of death row, and then you went to your second trial and were found not guilty. Have you heard from the prosecutors in the first case?
I have since my release, you know, February 18th of this year. I haven't heard from anybody from the state, from the Attorney General's office, from the FBI, or from the original prosecutors. And something that was really troubling to me on the day that I did attend the hearing is a mitigating factor that was found for the bar's hearing on the original prosecutors was that they had, in fact, shown an extreme amount of remorse for their actions. And, you know, I'm amazed that it was found as being an existing mitigating factor when I've never been contacted by any of them, neither has my family, and I don't see how you can show remorse by never speaking to the person that it actually affected.
You're saying you never got an apology.
Right, and that's another point of how weak the prosecution was during the hearing, because there were me and every member of my family could have spoken to the lack of, you know, an apology. And just for me, that is frustrating. I get asked that a lot. Has anybody ever, you know, offered an apology? And the answer is no.
Well, Alan Gill, we've run out of time for today, but I want to thank you for joining us. And I understand you're going to Martin Community College now?
Yes, I'm a full-time student there, trying to get a degree in social work.
Well, good luck with that. Thank you for being with us today.
All right. Thank you.
And that's the state of things for today. Our thanks to Alan Gill, Joe Neff. Joe Neff, a reporter with the Raleigh News and Observer, whose story about Alan Gill's case was instrumental in the second trial there. And Joe Kennedy, law professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you all. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about the program, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.